Doug Alinas from Springfield, Missouri. He'll be speaking about information method and ethos, production of a scientific person. Just welcome, Doug.
Thanks. Okay, I have three proposals for you, and three which may or may not work. We'll see. I have my view of them. Failures and foundations. We see, of course, the Leaning Tower of Pisa as a failure on some account. Okay, proposal one, information as foundation of a scientific education. The best account of science at any particular time is its expression in terms of nature, laws of nature, laws as foundations. I think this is straightforward. But the laws of nature are at best formulations of our attempt to reductively simulate nature. As foundations, they fail precisely because they are partial, incomplete, reductive approximations of reality, not reality itself. As we have aptly demonstrated in the last 500 years, and of course arguably to the beginning of our history, scientific information is never final. Recognition of this is a virtue, and humility is the parent of that virtue. Teaching science as information, as a catalog of truths, will therefore fail as a foundation because the information is constantly being modified by further research. Science is not on its explicitly a dogmatism. If it is, it's misplaced. It's made a mistake. That doesn't mean we don't teach the current state of the art. It also doesn't mean that scientific information is not moving closer to the reality which is at its source. And this is a critical reality where there is a reality irrespective of my opinion of it or contact with it. That its reliability is not a compelling foundation for our interactions with the world. It certainly is. It means that the core of a science education must be something beside information in order for science to remain viable for the student over a lifetime. We are looking for foundations, after all, for structural bases for continuing. All right, proposal two, methodology as foundation for a scientific education. Let's see, are we actually getting this here? See, I was afraid of this, and that my toys would not operate. Okay, undoubtedly the scientific method can be credited with much of the success of science in general. The persistence of a meticulous, carefully structured method makes it possible to collect the data that inscribes certainty in scientific laws. As foundations, they fail because they are tied to the particularities of the variety of examination, and they ossify errors they are not designed to see. This graphic, this GIF, was supposed to show a three-dimensional object which plays out like a two-dimensional object. And so, since you can't see it, I'm deeply sorry and troubled. Without the correct view, our methodology prevents us from seeing the reality that we're expecting. We actually do expect a reality, but we don't see what we need to see. The virtues of good method are repeatability, predictive success, and fruitfulness. But those virtues don't generate the scientific project or the serendipitous error and methods vary widely across disciplines. I don't think any of this is new or difficult to comprehend. I think we all understand this. But teaching science as method will therefore fail because there is no singular and efficacious method. That doesn't mean we don't teach methods, best practices, lab discipline, and craft competence. Means that the core of science education must be something besides methodology for science to remain viable for the student over a lifetime. Proposal three. Ethics, or an ethos, which is a lifestyle, philosophy as a way of life, science as a way of life, ethos as a foundation of a scientific education. Virtues of a scientist bring to the process transparency, honesty, and fruitfulness. The search for truth, this ethos implies, brings with it a number of dangers, and these are psychological and social dangers. As Michel Foucault famously said, knowledge is not made for understanding, it is made for cutting. The greatest enemies to the product of science are social and political, but psychology figures in as well. Not to deny the virtues of good information and method, but their very effectiveness are reliant on the character of the individual scientist. Mental talents such as intelligent wit and judgment, and temperaments such as courage, resoluteness, and perseverance are doubtless in many ways good and desirable, but they can become extremely bad and harmful if the person's character isn't good. So my thesis, scientific instruction should be inculcated in terms of objective moral character development. I don't think this is problematic. Now, we're going to look at the shared ethic. Lee Smolin in The Trouble with Physics. Science has succeeded because scientists comprise a community that is defined and maintained by adherence to a shared ethic. It is adherence to an ethic, not adherence to any particular fact or theory, that I believe serves as the fundamental corrective within a scientific community. Now, I have some handouts. Did you get anybody get a handout? Everybody get handouts? Okay. What's contained in the handouts, the first three pages, are Smolin's discussions concerning this ethic. There are only about 20 of these, but the last slide will contain a link where you can get the handout, the slideshow, and whatever. Okay. So it's adherence to an ethic, not adherence to any particular fact or theory, that I believe serves as the fundamental corrective within the scientific community to keep it on the correct path. There are two tenets of this ethic. If an issue can be decided by people of good faith, applying rational argument, publicly available evidence, then it must be regarded as so decided. And I think this is the case when we look at the age of the earth issues. I do not think we can continually trouble and persistently aggravate the young earth issue because I think it has already been so decided that the earth is not as young as some have claimed. If, on the other hand, rational argument from the publicly available evidence does not succeed in bringing people of good faith to agreement on an issue, society must allow and even encourage people to draw diverse conclusions. Of course, this isn't the mode of politics. The mode of politics is to resolve the issue by fiat and force us to forget that there's a problem. Now, here's the risky part. Deep-seated worry is often the reason for withdrawing commitment to truth. And I don't know about you, but at one point in my philosophical career, my philosophical growth, my journey, as I've been talking with my friend Mike Tennyson about, was the belief that my research would inevitably lead me to an agnostic and or atheistic position. Now, as a believer, this was repugnant to me. It nonetheless was a possibility, and I had to acknowledge the possibility. It didn't play out that way. But one's courage fails when a possible outcome promises contradiction of a core belief. Do we shy back from our work because it could cause some trouble? But if truth contradicts a core belief, then that belief must be wrong and should be abandoned, even with attendant problematic consequences. If we're not willing to make that leap, to take the consequences of our research, then frankly, folks, are we just dogmatically adhering to something which is problematic? And will turn out to be eventually wrong, and we've bet on the wrong horse. Okay, so how do we acquire the ethos? Much struggle, work, moral training, and, well, of course, the unknown. We don't know where this is going to take us. But the process of acquiring an ethical character requires training. My proposal is that ethical training should be at the center of a scientific education. Numerous writers and researchers have concluded that the suggestion of ethical obligation or lack of them influences the behavior of study participants. In other words, if they know that they are being watched and that there is a requirement for telling the truth, honesty, etc., they will, in fact, be more cautious about their responses on questions and answers to test questions, etc. But if they hear there are no particular rules associated with this, they will lie, cheat, and steal in order to acquire the best score. And this is fairly public. So now, C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man gives us the characteristics of moral instruction. He rehearses Augustine, Aristotle, and Plato, and I think this is instructive here. Augustine defines virtue as the ordinate condition of the affections in which every object is accorded that kind of degree of love which is appropriate to it. Aristotle says that the aim of education is to make the pupil like and dislike what he ought. When a person who has been trained in just sentiments, of course he didn't think anybody under the age of 30 was useful for politics because they had no association with public life. So when a person who has been trained in just sentiments and ordinate affections comes of age, they will easily find the first principles of ethics. But to the corrupt man, they will never be visible at all, and he can make no progress in that science. Plato, and of course this functions in my mind fairly well. The little human animal must be trained to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred at those things which are really pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful. And, you know, of course, if you have kids, you know about little human animals. Okay. When the child so trained reaches maturity, reason will come to him, reason with a capital R, and bred as he has been, he will hold out his hands in welcome and recognize her because of the affinity he bears for her. So the ethical training, this process of ethical training produces the possibility, when the individual matures, of holding on to an ethical point of view with respect to their work. I've mentioned a variety of ethical practices already, virtues of good methodology, repeatability, predictive success, fruitfulness, instruction in best practices, lab discipline, and craft competence. The failure to instill these virtues or to require them in scientific reporting is predictive of the failure of that project, irrespective of the intentions of its authors. The chief attitude in the face of this wondrous universe must be humility. I am changing horses midstream here, but the concept of humility, if this is not the center of our grasp of the world, then that's problematic. It turns into problems. The driving motivation for science must be the search for truth. Okay, so humility and the search for truth, and respect for that truth, even while truth is defined as probability. We understand, I think, fairly squarely that the best truth values we can achieve scientifically are probabilistic. Even if that probabilistic assertion of truth is disconfirmation of our core beliefs. Yet truth is not a simple object, as some would say it is an objective thing out there. It is a relationship we have with reality, where reality is not reduced for the convenience of logic to axioms and rules of inference, but retains the richness and messiness of our experience. I think this is essential, that we do not live in a reductionistic world. Okay, so caveats, critiques, psychology, sociology, politics, and religion. I've not yet mentioned the complexity of sociology or politics, because though their effects on science and knowledge are often tragic and unavoidable, they remain the fact of the scientific project embedded in human reality. The knowledge project does not take place without reference to the enclosing powers of ordinary lives. In fact, truth is often defined by which school you teach for, what company you work for, what your government says, if we're going to take evolutionary science in the Soviet Union, one must come up with a Marxist conclusion. The sociology of science, including all the failures to adhere to best ethical practices, only slows the progress of knowledge acquisition. In the end, the mass of data overrules the bad behavior of individuals and groups. Truth eventually wins out, of course, unless our civilization collapses, which it is often on the brink of. And let's face it, folks, we don't know whether we'll make it the next 10, 15, 20, 40 years without smearing each other out. We don't know that we're, we don't know. Okay. When the scientists must appeal to public, is that right? I mean, is this true? It's horrifying, but, may Jesus return. When the scientists, right, must appeal to public, and I don't know whether we're getting out before or after, or whether he's just going to come take us up and bring us back down and set us up. I have no idea how this is going to play out. All the biblical positions have good biblical grounds. So let me go on. When the scientists must appeal to public opinion or political pressure to promote their thesis, it's clear that the data on its own is not considered sufficiently compelling evidence for its truthfulness. And I think this is the deepest problem that Christianity has with the public sphere and with public science. Okay, examples: young earth creationism, string theory, and intelligent design. Note, I'm not challenging the truth of these proposals, and some of these proposals contain demonstrable effects of their truth. But on their failure to rely on a scientific ethos. Okay. Science and the processes and ethos of the scientist are not present in YEC, except in a very narrow range of projects which have nothing to do with historical science. The primary reason for using the products of science are in defense of a problematic interpretation of the scriptures and especially the Genesis 1-11 accounts of historical reality. The function of science in YEC has nothing to do often with discovery, but with critique of the scientific project insofar as it doesn't acknowledge their interpretation of the Bible as binding truth. The ethos of a scientist, therefore, has no place in YEC. They lack the courage for discovery of the truth. Now, I don't doubt their Christianity, please. Though often you'll find that if you challenge their thesis, they will challenge your Christianity. They will say you can't possibly believe that and be a Christian at the same time. And this is deeply disturbing. On Karl Barth's account, this is evidence of being a cult. Okay, string theory. The handout contains a good bit on string theory and some of the bad behavior of string theorists. It's been criticized as a project that has no testable empirical content. That's not entirely true, but the tests are beyond our current ability to perform. We'd need a lab the size of the universe, some have said, in order to test it. But the error of the string theoretic community is heavy-handed politics. They have their hand in research grants and political committees and use their influence to prevent the promotion of other projects. But their project is still largely theoretical with no testable correspondence to the real world. Of the three proposals I examine here, ID has the best chance. However, when it relies on political force to insinuate its arguments into the public sphere, it's diminished as a scientific project, especially in its association with YEC or even OEC. Now, on the scale of beliefs concerning the interaction between God and the universe, say between Ken Ham and Howard Van Til, the chart that you put up last was there. Van Til is second to the left, and Ken Ham on the right. Between God as special creator and God as creator of fully gifted nature, we don't have a firm answer. It may be that we can't know. But the more we rely on a special creation model, the less we can do science, because the creationist absurd remains at the bottom of the emergence of order, and one can know nothing about what one believes is beyond knowability. So there's no reason to examine what we can't know. We can't figure out how God did it. Well, we don't think. Yeah, thank you. So science is held hostage by extra scientific dogma. Is science made barren? When we're forced to obey an external sort of rule, science runs into trouble. Okay, my conclusion. Scientists with an ethos as described above, with humility and seeking for truth as the ground, and with honesty as a core, stands the best chance of providing access to the truth of reality, because they're not swayed by groupthink, corporate funding, popular opinion, political pressure, or extra scientific dogma, nor do they appeal to these social and psychological pathologies for assurance. And I think they are pathologies. This is brokenness. Okay. So this is the bit, last bit. Instruction in ethics as the foundation of scientific education stands as a credible and sustainable means of promoting both the integrity of the scientist and the scientific project, the production of a scientific person. And this is all here. Okay, so we're actually going to get it. There's the URL, and I'll entertain some questions. Now, we're still stuck with the problematic ability.
We didn't need to repeat the question or some way.
Right, okay, I'll do that. Sorry. Right, that's fine. Yes?
Thank you.
Sure.
When you're talking about ethic and going back to the classical Greeks,
right,
it seems to me that maybe we need to be educating our students in various disciplines on what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly.
Right.
It seems to me that this, your presentation is leaning, well, we need to look at a theology of beauty. And I think of Thomas Dubay's Evidential Power of Beauty, Science and Theology Meet. So perhaps you could comment a bit on how beauty might be part of this ethical training.
Okay, how would beauty be part of ethical training? Since it seems that we ought to be addressing what the Greeks required was training in what is good, bad, and what is ugly, we should deal with aesthetics as well. The SPS conference next year is on aesthetics. So if you're going or not going, doesn't matter. Aesthetics, I think of Tim Keller when I think of aesthetics, that the beauty of the universe is not a proof for the existence of God. I appreciate what we heard from Alistair McGrath. We're not looking for proofs anymore, any kind of Loctite logic and evidentiary absolutes. We are looking for, I think Keller's nomenclature is useful here. We're looking for clues. And if we can offer beauty as a clue, right, the evanescent, transformative character of beauty has to mean something more than just what it is. Beauty has to be going somewhere. Yes, I think it's true that we have to understand beauty in some fashion. But Immanuel Kant made it his third critique, right? The critique of judgment, critique of taste. It does not fall under the same rubrics as either ethics or reason itself. So we're not going to be able to find an absolute, but as a clue, the appreciation of and the exploration of beauty should and must necessarily be a part of that, right? I think maybe I can make it go. No, I didn't do that. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Doesn't science, the way it works, have enough checks and balances? So if a scientist doesn't have a good ethic, if he's cheating or being dishonest, he'll be caught. Let me give an example. Many years ago, Ernie Menendez, a nuclear physicist, I interacted with him. He's a Secretary of Energy now.
Uh-huh.
And we know that the Iran government doesn't have a high ethic. But Ernie Menez claims there's enough checks and balances in what was signed with Iran that if Iran tries to cheat, we will know about it. And isn't that the way science should work or not?
Yes, certainly. And of course, I acknowledge this. Out in the open, caught with their pants down. How often in the last 10 years has the AAAS published papers that turn out to be fraudulent? How often do scientists fudge their data in order to get better results? It comes to light. Eventually, it comes to light. We find it. We discover it, nasty as it is. And of course, the public perception of science is always worse after one of these events. But yes, I think this is Smolin's argument, that as long as we adhere to the shared ethos, shared ethic, there is a chance that eventually we will be able to sort these kinds of things out. And even when there is bad data or fraudulent data, that we will be able to. So, I mean, but if the scientist has no interest in adhering to the shared ethic, but rather to their own promotion, to their own pocket, to their Nobel Prize, which is not deserved, to whatever kind of thing that they're aiming at, that they, if they think they can get away with it and do, this does not forward the project of science, either publicly or privately, or in the scientific world. So yes, I think it eventually comes out that the lies turn out as lies, but not always. Yeah.
You were kind of hard on string theory. And I know, well, Gerald Cleaver is probably not here yet, but he's going to be talking on that here on Monday. Could you argue that even though right now it's not falsifiable through experimentation, perhaps we might in the future find a way to test some of these string theories a little bit more stringently than we know how to do today?
Right, absolutely. Can we test string theory? Is it actually a viable project? And I think yes, it is a viable project as far as it goes. But when they use their political force to dominate an environment which is deeply uncertain as it is, then this is a mistake. Are we going to have to be appealing to Tom Kuhn, who says the only way that a new theory comes to light is when the old professors die out, right? I mean, is this what's going to have to happen? Yeah.
One more?
Yes.
Can you explain who should be doing this ethical training? Is that something that should be coming from the science professors, or is that something that, is that part of a liberal arts education? Where does that come from?
Yes. Who should be doing the ethical education? Well, the science professor who believes in their project, right, would be doing everything they can to make the student an honest participant. But is it hard to get students to participate honestly? Go ahead, nod your heads. Yes, you know it's hard to get them to do that. I once caught a student cheating on an ethics test. What fun is that? when you're telling them they have to do X and Y and Z, and that it's up to them, and they have to know what they do, and they have to do the test honestly, and they try to cheat, and of course, I don't think I caught all the cheaters, right? And I don't think any of us as professors catch all the cheaters. I'll go. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.